Okay, I want to thank the organizer for inviting me to this workshop, and it's a pleasure to see so many familiar faces in the audience. I'm going to tell you about elasticity of entropy-dominated systems. I will going to present you some more recent and less recent results on the subject. The less recent results, but maybe the most important results in this work, have been obtained by Odette Farago 8 years ago. He was my PhD student at that time. More recent results, which I will present at the end of this lecture, were obtained in collaboration with Michael Morat from SOREC Research Center. Now, and there are a few additional names here of additional people with whom I collaborated on various side projects of this main subject of elasticity. Now, the outline of my talk is as follows. I will first tell you the goal of this talk, the study of entropy-dominated systems, and in particular, I will compare elasticity with other kinds of physical features, such as conductivity of random systems. Eventually, I will talk a little bit about differences between energetic and entropic elasticity, and I briefly describe the method which we derived for calculating elastic constants of such systems. The second part of the talk will be essentially results. One group of the results will be calculation of elastic constants of percolating systems, entropic percolating systems, while the last results will be about hard sphere or hard ellipse systems. Those are more recent results. Now, for you to have some idea what kind of systems they have in mind, the easiest thing to imagine is just imagine yourself polymer melt in which you start cross-linking polymers, and gradually they create larger and larger clusters. At some point, an infinite cluster spanning the entire system appears, and this point in polymer physics is called a gel point. So liquid becomes solid at that point. And this is the kind of system I want you to have in mind when I'm going to talk about formalism, etc. However, already at this point, I would like to mention that really, one, in order to have a solid response, such as shear modulus, etc., you do not really need to have a molecule spanning the entire system. You may have something which looks like that, which Degen called the Olympic gel, namely a system of interlocked polymers, so it doesn't have to be continuous polymer. This is enough to create an entropic response. When Degen defined the system, for him it was kind of, you know, fantasy system which he hoped that experimentalists would at some point produce. But actually, such systems do exist. I don't know if you can clearly see it here, but this is DNA, ring molecules of DNA which are interlocked like chainmail. This is DNA extracted from an actual organelle of flagellum. So you actually have those interlocked things. So molecules of this type exist. So this I just want you to keep it in your mind, because at the very end I'll come back to this point. Now, I'm interested in the elasticity of random systems, and actually the system is quite old. The question is quite old. Already in the 70s, people asked much simpler question. It had nothing to do with entropic elasticity. They said, what would happen if you have a very tenuous solid structure? What are the elastic constants of that structure? This is an example of experiment, much later experiment on porous ceramics, where you have grains fused together, and you want to calculate shear modulus or bulk modulus of such system. Now, in order to calculate such thing, a theoretician needs two things. First of all, he needs something which will describe the geometry of this thing, and another thing, something which will give the Hamiltonian, will define the energy. Now, the geometry, usually what people do, they say, okay, it's a random system, let's represent it by a percolating system. Percolating system is just taking a regular two or three dimensional lattice and randomly placing bonds here they're shown as red bonds on that lattice. As you place more and more bonds, at some point you create clusters, larger and larger clusters. At some point you have an infinite cluster, and this is called percolation point. This is percolation concentration. Beyond that point, it's already a continuous object. And if you measure a bulk modulus and shear modulus, you expect that bulk and shear modulus increase as you move away from to concentrations even larger, as some power law. That was the expectation already in 70s. However, people didn't really investigate this system, and the reason why they didn't do it because they thought that they actually knew the answer to this question. The answer was supposed to come from a very different system. Suppose that instead of having those solid grains and voids, you have mixture of metal and insulator. So when the concentration of metal is low, you have an insulating system. Once you cross the percolation threshold, it starts conducting, and you can ask what is the conductivity of this system as a function of the distance from the percolation threshold. And this system, in the case of percolation, what is shown here is a random resistor network on a regular lattice. Such system has been studied very extensively. Now, of course, that this is a very simplified system. You have a regular lattice and resistors are either present, shown here in red, or absent, shown in black. But from the point of view of the exponent, it's supposed to represent the same thing as continuous system of grain. That system was known very well in 70s, and it was known that exponent t depends only on space dimension, but not on some minor details of the system, and it's equal to 1.3 in two dimensions, 1.9 in three dimensions. It was kind of assumed, since the equations which govern the system at least superficially are similar to equations of elasticity, that something like that would happen also with elasticity, although people realize that elasticity distortions are vectorial objects. Well, here we have potentials which are scalars. Nevertheless, it was believed that it is the same system. Now, how would you make this random resistor network into something elastic? So the simplest thing you could do, you would say, okay, let's replace our resistors by hook and springs. But once you do that, you immediately see that things do not work. This is an example of a percolating cluster on two-dimensional triangular lattice. The red bonds represent those hook and springs. You can see here that there is a continuous cluster from one end of the system to another. However, if you look at this thing carefully, you can clearly see that if you hold the bottom plate and start shearing the top plate, there will be no resistance. This system exhibits no resistance. It has essentially no rigidity. Actually, you need a very high concentration of bonds for this system to support shear. Namely, its rigidity threshold is higher than its percolation threshold. Why this is happening is quite obvious. You know, why can you shear this thing? Because there are no resistance to change in angle between the bonds. That's the reason why pure hook and springs cannot support stress here. So all you need to do is to introduce bond bending forces, and it was done in the 80s. If you take a percolating system and in addition to hook and springs, you introduce forces which it would cost you energy to change angle between two bonds, you restore the threshold again. Both bulk and shear modulus appear beyond the percolation threshold. However, if you look at this system, what are the critical exponents of these systems? So you discover, and that I studied with Yitzhak Webman in 84, you discover that exponent tau is significantly larger than the conductivity exponent. Instead of 1.3 and 1.9, you have 3.6 and 3.8. So the numbers are much larger. What does it mean that the numbers are large? It actually means two things. First of all, that if one makes an experiment, probably it shouldn't be very difficult to distinguish between these two exponents. Second thing, because those numbers are so large, it means that when we approach the percolation threshold from above, since the exponent is so huge that the elastic constants drop extremely fast to zero. But if they drop extremely fast to zero, when we are very close to the percolation threshold, the elastic resistance will be already so small that at finite temperature, the fluctuations will become so large that the actually various branches of this system will start bumping into each other. And the behavior of the system will no longer be determined by the calculation which has been made here, because this was a purely energetic calculation, zero temperature calculation. And indeed, when people try to measure shear modulus of gels, this is measurement of shear modulus of a silica gel as a function of something which is proportional to concentration or to the distance from the gelation point, they found the following, that far away from the threshold, this is a logarithmic scale, far away from the threshold, the slope is 3.6. So it behaves as we expected for elasticity with a Benny constant. However, very close to the percolation threshold, the exponent seems to change something closer to 2. Similar behavior is here, it's the same experiment just with slightly different pH. And another experiment is shown here. Here again, the shear modulus to some power is shown as a concentration, as a function of concentration crosslinkers, and the slope, which here corresponds to the critical exponent, is 1.93. Again, it more resembles the results of conductivity than the results of elasticity. So it seems that once things start fluctuating very strongly, their behavior is no longer determined by energy, but something else, which looks more like conductivity. However, from the theoretical point of view, there was really no possibility to calculate those things.
Usually, if you write a power law like the one you've written there, then the power law should be valid near the transition. I mean, you're saying then if you go, it holds only further away, but near the transition there's a change. Then, I mean, how did you get the other values you were quoting, 3.8 and 3.6?
Oh, those values were obtained, what I showed you on the transparencies ago, those were values which were obtained numerically by simply solving the system pure energy. You shear it and you calculate the elastic response. So it was zero temperature calculation. Here, experiments are performed at finite temperature, so sufficiently close to the gel threshold, that theoretical calculation is no longer valid because the temperature is high enough for fluctuations to become so strong that the entire concept becomes invalid. Now, what happens?
This is a time plot now.
Yes. What people would like to measure is to measure shear modulus as a function of concentration of crosslinkers. Now, what they actually have, they have concentration of crosslinks increasing with time. So within 10 hours, they go from concentration 1% to concentration 50%. What they actually do at various times, they perform measurement. Now, since the change is so slow, if you perform the measurement, it's just a measurement by, you just shake the gel and you measure the response. It's essentially a static measurement because the dynamics is extremely slow. So what happens when they try to share it and they see it's a liquid. Then they wait a little bit more and they say at some point they discover that it's already a solid and this is the gel point, but it's measured in time units essentially.
So when I was a kid and my mother was making Jell-O, she kept telling me don't touch, but of course what do you do? So this is the experiment where it's a viscous fluid but it's progressing on its own. That's
yes.
Side of it.
Yes.
It's not the time as an independent, it is a
No, usually it is done by ultraviolet. You don't really need time. By ultraviolet illumination, you stimulate the creation of crosslinks.
Okay.
It doesn't matter, because if you think about it, all you need is assurance that number of crosslinks is a monotonic function of time, and that's it. You don't need because it's some kind of function. It doesn't matter. At some point, it's just constant plus something. So for the power law relations, it doesn't matter.
It's important to identify the PG time where.
Yes. But that is done kind of retroactively. What they do, they measure shear modulus at various times. And then they need, so they have it as a function of time. And then you have some fitting parameter you need to do it, yeah. That's why, this curve, beyond certain point, you cannot even draw it because you don't know the... But it quite accurately. It's not...
So to get the red line, you're doing this gentle perturbation while time just flows.
Yeah.
You can speed up time or slow down time. By adding agents to
it. Yes. It's essentially, from their point of view, it's a static measurement because the progression of the gelation is so slow that.
But I'm going, shaking, hitting, whatever, and I'm getting something here.
Yeah.
And the idea is that the rate does not matter. I'm trying to make sense of the slope here. So if I'm plotting something versus time, I have to have some idea what. Is or is not happening with time in your
count? It's a time, if you look at the linear scale. So you're measuring something, it is 0, 0, 0, 0, and then it starts increasing. That's all that happens. And you take this increase and say, okay, where did it start increase? Let's measure, put it on logarithmic scale.
During the time you're calculating 3.6, there's some assumption about a rate of formation of links.
No. You're not calculating anything. When you are measuring, you're just measuring as a function of time.
Right.
You see, this is simply linear in time. It's time minus constant, what's shown here. So you're just measuring, and that's it. You have a curve. As a function of time, you're measuring something which looks like that. That's what you measure as function of time. And then you say, okay, let's assume that somewhere here is the beginning and plot it logarithmically.
And it would make a difference if you had something in there that speeded up, because it would just be isomorphic to that.
It doesn't matter, because it would just...
Power?
No, it wouldn't change the power. It would change the prefactor. It would change the prefactor.
T minus Tg is P minus Pc to some power. It changes the power.
No, it does not.
That's what I'm having trouble with.
If you multiply T by 10, it still will be the same power. It will be 10T minus 10Tc to the same power.
No, if it's P minus Pc to some power.
Oh, no, but it's not power. You see, time, there is nothing singular at this point. It's just... Okay.
The number of crosslinks.
The number of crosslinks as a function of time is such function. Nothing particular happens at this point. Yeah. Okay. Now, what is a few words? What is entropic elasticity? This is the following quantity. Now, let's look at something simple. Suppose you have one polymer, and for simplicity, let us assume that every segment of this polymer can point in completely arbitrary direction. Then, end-to-end vector of the polymer is equal just to sum of independent random variables, and according to the central limit theorem, if number of variables is very large, then the probability of end-to-end distance will have just Gaussian probability distribution, meaning that number of configurations also has a Gaussian probability distribution. What it simply means that there are very few stretch configurations and many configurations when the two ends are close to each other. So if you take logarithm of this number of configurations, you get something which looks like kr squared. So it is proportional. It looks as if it's a spring which wants to contract, because there are many contracted configurations and few stretch configurations. Usually when I tell this story, somebody comes up at the end of the lecture and asks me, yeah, but why these things really wants to contract? Because in statistical mechanics, we kind of say, oh, system wants to be in high entropy state. Why would the system want to be in that state? So let us look at the same thing I showed you before in a simpler way. Suppose you have only a triatomic molecule with bonds of fixed length. Now, suppose I keep those two atoms in place and allow the third atom to do whatever it wants. Now I'm asking the third year undergraduate student to calculate what force should be applied here so that this thing stays in place. Now, what would that third year student do? He would do the following calculation. He would say, look, those atoms are held in place. The central atom can move on a circle. So the entire available phase space is 2 pi r. Therefore, if I take a logarithm of 2 pi r, multiply it to minus k Boltzmann t, that would give me the entropic part of the free energy. To that, I should probably add also some kinetic energy, which I will immediately drop afterwards. But this is the free energy, just temperature times k Boltzmann logarithm of the phase space. And if I express this little r as a function of length of the bond r and distance capital R between those two end atoms, I get this expression. So this is the free energy. Notice that I already dropped the kinetic part. Why? Because the next step, all I want to know how free energy depends on the distance between two end atoms. So I take derivative with respect to R, and this kinetic energy plays no role here at all. And I take derivative of this expression, I get something like that. Something like that, it means that the restoring force, I'm keeping is there a question?
Yeah, just neglect any interactions between atoms in polymers, just treat it like
This is just forget polymers, just one molecule consisting of three atoms, two are kept in place, the third one is moving. All I want to see where this force, why does it want to contract? Now, if you calculate this way, and this is kind of statistical mechanical calculation, you would say that the force is given by this expression. It is zero when the two ends are near each other. It increases linearly and then diverges when this thing is stretched. Now, this is pure statistical mechanics. It doesn't tell us anything where this force is coming from. Now, let us pose the same question to the first year undergraduate student, and he would solve it in a much more transparent way. He would say the following. Now, suppose you have two atoms here, and this guy going here in circles. Since it is moving in circle, some centripetal force must be applied to it. Where this force is, this centripetal force is actually mv squared over r, where r is this radius. Where this force can come from? It can come from stress in the bonds. Now, where the stress in the bonds is coming from? From the forces which are applied at the end. And this way, he simply finds that force is equal to mv squared over r times some geometric factor. So this is purely, that's what is called in mechanics inertial regulator. This thing is pulling those the endpoints together. Now if you will tell this first year undergraduate student that mv squared on the average should be k Boltzmann t, he will give you this expression for the force. And if you look what is shown here, it is exactly the same formula which we had before. So this is kind of an interesting thing, because you see here it came really from the kinetic energy. Well, the statistical mechanics calculation kind of hides it, because the kinetic part of energy dropped, We took the derivative of the phase space, but it's essentially the same answer. Statistical mechanics kind of has its way of hiding the actual source of forces. But this is essentially the real origin. So there is nothing magic about those entropic forces. Those are real forces. Simply in statistical mechanical calculations, they look to come just from some kind of calculations of volume. Okay. Now let us look at some purely entropic systems, and one very nice entropic system is Hartzsphere system. So here they are. Now it looks like a very simple system. It has been studied for almost 100 years. It's actually a non-trivial system because, for instance, if you have only repulsive interactions. Nevertheless, such system undergoes a transition from fluid to solid, and this was known already almost 100 years ago, in 1814 actually. This thing was known that there is no need for attractive interactions to solidify something. This was also the first system which was studied by Monte Carlo. Metropolis, the famous Metropolis Monte Carlo paper, studied exactly this kind of system because it's very easy to study it. Because all those spheres in three dimensions, or disks in two dimensions, the interaction is trivial. It's configuration either permitted, and then the energy is zero, or it's forbidden. What is so the potential looks like that, zero or infinity. Notice that it means that the system has no energy scale. Therefore, K-Boltzmann has nothing to do really in the system. It will appear because free energy must have dimensions of energy, but K-Boltzmann will appear just a prefactor. Whatever we do, eventually will be multiplied by K-Boltzmann to give it the correct dimensions. That's the only way, trivial way, in which temperature appears. Since we want also to calculate systems of polymers, we want some kind of connectivity between monomers. So what we will introduce? We introduce a tethering potential, which is something which connects two atoms, and it is zero until they reach some maximal distance. Beyond that distance, they are not allowed to separate. This will be our bond. Notice that once you have atoms connected by such bonds and repelling each other with the hardcore interactions, you have system which in which temperature plays absolutely no role. Once we have that, we can begin calculating elastic constants, because we are sure the system which has those potentials has no energy at all. It's pure. Everything that will be there, it will be pure entropy. Now, what does it mean to calculate elastic constants of such system? I will show you on the example of not polymer but hard sphere system. What you are supposed to do is the following. You have a system of hard spheres, you're supposed to calculate its free energy. Free energy just to estimate the available phase space, you know, how many configurations can there be. Then, to calculate various shear modulus or pressure or something, you need to distort the boundaries, and you need to calculate how many states are possible here. This will be another free energy, and then you have to take a derivative of that thing with respect with the distortion. Namely, you need to see how many states are available here more than in the second configuration. For instance, here you have a forbidden configuration, which that difference which will create this restoring force. However, physicists do not like to work with systems of this kind because I'm telling you that I should distort the boundaries. Boundaries are usually at infinity. Nobody cares about the boundaries. And to calculate various quantities which depend on the deformation of boundaries is very inconvenient. But what you can do the following. You can change the coordinates to a new coordinate such that those boundaries in new coordinates, just a linear transformation, in new coordinates the boundaries are restored to their original shape, but you pay a price. Because you distorted the coordinates, you also distorted your potentials. So now you have exactly the same the same boundary shape, but you calculate the difference in free energies between regular potential and distorted potentials. So you really need to find how many configurations are more available here than there. Now, I would like to remind you that all those distortions are infinitesimal. So you really need a configuration which is allowed configuration here and becomes disallowed after infinitesimal distortion. How can it be that infinitesimal distortion does it? If two spheres touch in the original configuration, the distortion may just bring them beyond that point that they start overlapping, and that will create create a probing configuration. So obviously that the answer, which I will not show the formula, but it must depend on those touching configurations. At least in the case of if you try to calculate stress or pressure, this is actually the formula, and that's the last formula which I'm going to show here. That in order to calculate pressure in a system of this type, you need to multiply some kind of separation between atoms at the point when they touch each other, or if you also have bonds, if you have those tethers connecting those guys, also there is a contribution with the opposite sign of configurations where the bond is stretched. Now that shouldn't be terribly surprising. You know, before that I've explained it from the free energy consideration, but if you think about it, what is pressure? Pressure is some kind of force. Forces appear when those things either touch each other or the bonds are stretched. That's the only moment when there are forces in this system. Otherwise there are no forces. So somehow these configurations should appear here. Now, stress is the first derivative of free energy. Elastic constants are second derivatives. I will not show you the formulas because they are something from the nightmares. But I will just tell you what those formulas include. In order to calculate the elastic constants of such solid, we need to know probability density of two such events happening simultaneously, namely this pair of atoms touch each other and this pair of atoms touch each other simultaneously. We need to know this probability distribution. Or we have a triplet of atoms with two contacts happening simultaneously. If we know those probabilities, those probabilities of two events happening together, we can calculate the elastic constant. Usually it cannot be done analytically, but numerically the recipe is clear. You simply run the simulation and you look for events when the things touch or almost touch each other, and from there you substitute in some enormous formula and you calculate the elastic constants. Now, once we had those expressions, which I'm not showing to you, we decided, okay, let's calculate elastic constants of something and see how it works. So one thing, here is the simplest example which we tried, two-dimensional percolating system without excluded volume interactions at all. So we have a point-like atoms which are randomly connected by bonds. How did we do it? First, we put the system on a lattice, and we randomly placed bonds on this triangular lattice. So those will be our atoms, and those will be bonds. Those will be the tethers, which will not allow the atoms to separate. Once we created this topology on a lattice, we presume that this thing is in continuum and allowed this thing to equilibrate. This is the equilibrium state of exactly the same system. This is that in equilibrium. You equilibrate this thing, you substitute, you look, in this case there are no extreme volume interactions, there are only stretching contacts, but there are those points, you use them, you calculate shear modulus, you draw shear modulus on a semi-logarithmic scale as function of P minus PC, and you get exponent 1.3, like in two-dimensional conductivity. But
two points,
they are not allowed to move further apart than certain distance.
They are not allowed to overlap.
They are allowed to overlap. There is absolutely no, those are point-like atoms, but those which were connected in this original configuration, that was distance 1. They are not allowed to separate more than, I think, 1.2 or something like that. There is some maximal distance. In between, no force. So connectivity remains, but you see what happens. They are kind of trying to contract as much as they can because there is no excluded volume. They're trying to contract, but, you know, the boundaries are keeping them, so that's the best they can do in their attempt to collapse. In the absence of boundaries, you know, this thing would just collapse. Notice that here are both finite clusters and large cluster. Everything is here. We got exponent 1.3 lacking conductivity, but that was not terribly surprising. Actually, in the absence of excluded volume interactions, not with this potential, but with a slightly simpler potential, I can prove that shear modulus behave exactly like conductivity. Unfortunately, that proof works only for a system without excluded volume interactions, when the interaction is only between connected neighbors, no additional interaction. So that the fact that we got here a conductivity result was not terribly surprising. What happens for a system when you have excluded volume interactions? And here is exactly the same thing, but now atoms have a certain diameter and they are not allowed to overlap. The method of generation of topology is exactly the same, but you see the configuration, it looks very, very, very different. And here you can measure various things. So for instance, you can measure bulk modulus as a function of P, and you see that when the concentration of bonds is larger, it is larger, then it decreases. Nothing particular happens to bulk modulus at the percolation threshold, because bulk modulus of the liquid and of the solid, they are more or less the same at that point. Nothing drastic happens at this point. However, the shear modulus goes from something to zero, and if it is drawn on a logarithmic scale, it's not a very broad range, but you know, there is two-thirds of a decade, it has a slope 1.3 lacking conductivity. So it seems here is a system which we cannot solve, etc. It's just what I'm telling you, this is the numerical result, the exponent 1.3 like in the case of conductivity. Yeah, those are two different cases of excluded volume, yeah.
And that becomes a big deal when A gets down to, you know, 0.1 or something. I mean, how does one think about that? Is it just a volume filling thing? Or
yes, this is really a volume fraction, because all of them, all atoms are present. You see, bonds were introduced randomly, but atoms were all there. So actually, when A is very, very large, it actually will solidify even without bonds.
Right, that's what I was asking you. So yeah. A started to get small.
Okay, when it is small, it gradually will cross over to phantom case. Where,
I'm not being an extremist. I just want to get some idea of what's big and what's small.
So. Yeah, it's, you know, the somewhere around 1 or something like that is more or less the limit of maximal density. I don't remember the number, but it's further away. The other way, the point is that we wanted to go to large A's, because for small A's we know that in phantom case it's like conductivity. So that end is known. The point is to show that the opposite end, it still looks like conductivity. Well, here there is really no reason why it should be like that. Yes.
So the case A equals zero would be the one that you discussed before.
Yes.
And where would it be in this plot? Because it also has a slope 1.3, isn't it?
Yes. Oh no. But it would be with the same slope, but the curve would be somewhere here. You see, when you are shifting A, it's becoming shear modulus becomes smaller and smaller. Just prefactor. But anyway, we repeated the same thing in three dimensions, and here is a three-dimensional object. Here I intentionally reduced the size of the sphere so that you can see how those things look in three dimensions. And the exponent was 2. Again, more or less like the exponent of conductivity. At that point, we said, okay, so we simulated, we created formalism, which was intended to simulate those systems. And for the first time, we actually succeeded telling numerically the behavior of such systems, which corresponded to the experimental results, which also looked like conductivity. So we were happy with those results, and that more or less looked like as the end of the story, because really we intended to work with random systems. At that point, it looked to us that maybe, you know, regular solids, you know, they have been studied for 40 years. There is nothing particularly interesting there, but actually there is something interesting there. with the regular solids. And that's the story which I wanted to tell you in the last 15 or 20 minutes. Now, let us start from the year 1585, when a gentleman called Harriot asked what is the densest possible assembly of cannonballs. And this assembly looked quite obvious. That's how it should look. You know, everyone, every guy who stacks oranges in market knows how to arrange those things. So that looks like this thing. It took a few years for Kepler to conjecture that this is the densest possible stacking, and it took another 200 years for Gauss to prove that this is densest possible periodic stacking. Now, assuming that this is periodic, this is the densest possible stacking. There is no real proof regarding non-periodic stacking, although in 1898 appeared proof which is still disputed by many people, which claims to have proven that this is general statement, that both, also if you consider non-periodic configurations, this is the densest possible case. Okay, so that's the densest stacking. However, I want you to notice that actually it's not a single stacking, but there are several such stackings. First of all, look at the bottom layer. Here I'm trying to stack those spheres. So those white circles, that's a view from above. This is the obvious configuration of the bottom layer. Then I need to place another layer, layer B. I'm just placing those spheres in between the spheres of the bottom layer. I do it here, I do it here. Then I need to place the third layer. Now, in the third layer, I have a choice. I can either place the atom which is in between the spheres of the second layer and exactly above an atom in the first layer, or there is a different position, which is shown here, which is in between the atoms here, and it is not above an atom in the first layer. So here we have configuration A, B, A, B, etc. Here we have A, B, C, A, B, C, A, B, C, etc. Of course, there are all other possible arrangements which you can do. These both configurations have exactly the same density. If you periodically repeat this thing, that will be called hexagonal closed packing. If you periodically repeat this thing, it will be called a face central cubic. Okay, so you have at least two stackings with the same density, but this is just geometry. Now let's go to statistical mechanics. What can you say about the free energy of those things? Now, if you are at the densest possible stacking, there is really nothing to say there. There is one state and that's it. But what happens if you took this stacking and reduced the diameter of spheres just a little bit? Then the spheres can move, and you can ask yourself, what is the free energy per atom? What is the entropy? What is the entropy per atom? How much entropy there is here, or how much energy there is there? And then you have a difference. In fact, the difference is per atom 0.001 K Boltzmann T. Notice it's a thermic system, so K Boltzmann T just appears as a prefactor. N is the number of atoms, so it's 1,000. This is the difference between the free energy of this stacking as opposed to free energy of that stacking, and it goes all the way. You know, when you approach the maximal concentration, the difference remains the same difference.
So you're saying that number is not a function of the reduction in the radius?
Okay, first of all, this is only when the radius approaches the maximal radius. But what happens, you should keep in mind, it's a classical system. So the volume, available volume, goes to zero. Logarithm of that goes to infinity, to minus infinity. Yeah? Minus infinity. So this and this, they both go to minus infinity, and the difference between them remains this. So the ratio between available phase spaces remains fixed. They both go to zero, but the ratio remains fixed. So even if this is,
noble this and noble that, packing FCC, BCC. So you're saying that this part of it is so small that it's going to be depending on potential.
Oh yes, and yeah. If you notice that all those references here, they start at 68 and they continue till 99. And it's not accidental, because if it would be so obvious, And so clear, the difference is so small that first of all, it's almost a miracle that people measured it. Keep in mind, they measured free energy. Usually, you know, in simulations, free energy is the worst thing that one can try to measure in simulations. But they measured. There are still a little bit arguments about that, but I think this is more or less settled.
Yeah, and now people, as I say, are putting in all kinds of potentials.
Oh, yeah, you can easily go from here to there. Yeah. You can easily go from here to there. Excuse me?
More recently, there are DFT calculations, density functional theory calculations for hard spheres and how they pack.
I know that. I don't remember whether there was ever a claim. From time to time appears a claim that, you know, that this is actually incorrect, that those things are inverted, but I think this is already rather well established. You know, this is not the only question. Now, people want to know elastic constants, etc. But okay. But all I wanted to tell you that even in such trivial system, there are some kind of acute questions which one can ask. Now, if you instead of spheres, you take ellipsoids, for instance, spheroids, then the system becomes even more interesting. If you have spheroids in three dimensions, if they are not terribly elongated and the density is low, you will have just an isotropic liquid. If they're very strongly elongated, they will orient and more or less all of them look in the same direction, and that what will be called the pneumatic liquid. Now, when you go to higher density, there are two possibilities. If they are strongly elongated, eventually this liquid will become solid, and it will be ordered atoms, and they will all be oriented identically. However, if the elongation is very small, either oblate spheroids or prolate spheroids, it will be what is called plastic solid. Namely, the atoms will be ordered like in solid. However, they will be disordered rotationally. It looks very strange that such thing can exist, but think about this thing that, you know, when it's a sphere, obviously it can rotate. So small deviation from sphericity allows you to keep ordered solid with disordered orientation. So this is known, and again, Frankel and his group studied those things for 20 years, and systems of this type kind of, they always served as prototypes for various pneumatic systems, etc. Now, what we wanted to do, Michael Murat and I wanted to do the same thing in two dimensions with the two-dimensional ellipse to study the phase diagram, and we also kind of derived the formalism which allowed us to calculate elastic constants of those things. So we said, okay, we'll try to find the phase diagram of the system, and we will calculate the elastic constants. We have four formulas for doing that. So we started doing that, and we found a phase diagram which looks like that. You have here, it's a two-dimensional system. Those are ellipses, not strongly elongated ellipses. What is shown here, the aspect ratio is 1.5. And at low, so we are here along this line. This is the aspect ratio. At low concentration, we just have a liquid. Okay, we also studied those things in for larger elongations, and for instance, if the elongation is large, we have something which looks like a pneumatic liquid, etc. So we more or less found this phase diagram. However, the story which I want to tell you is just what is happening along this particular line. So as I said, at low concentrations, it's an isotropic liquid. Then when you go slightly higher concentration, you get something which looks like an exotic. We couldn't really exactly verify that it's exotic. Exotic is a two-dimensional liquid in which if you connect centers of neighboring atoms by bonds, those directions of those bonds have quasi long range order, although the positions of atoms are disordered. So this is a liquid with a little bit order, and we think that we have exotic order here, but this is not so important to what I'm going to tell. This entire phase diagram is quite approximate. Then when we go to even higher concentration, we go to this point, we get what I called before plastic plastic solid, namely the positions of atoms become ordered. In two dimensions, they cannot be really ordered, but this is a quasi long range order. But orientations of the atoms, they are completely not oriented, so each atom looks at a different direction. So that's nice, a little bit resembles the thing which we had in three dimensions. And finally, we go to even higher concentration, close to the maximal possible concentration, which is in those dimensionless units, it's 1.15. So we are going somewhere to above to 1.1, and we have a solid in which all atoms are oriented. And notice how they are oriented. They are oriented here that each ellipse just kind of looks in between two neighboring ellipses, just in the hole between the two adjacent ellipses. This is the orientation. So that looked to us that when we finished that you know, okay, we found the phase diagram, what more or less what was expected. However, we also calculated the elastic constants of those things. Just, you know, we used it as an example to verify our expressions. And for low concentration, we actually found that the shear modulus is zero, which was an indication that it's a liquid. And then shear modulus became finite, which was indication that we are indeed in the solid phase, so everything was okay. Until we got to the highest concentration where we had, and we got some elastic constants. Elastic constants are shown here, they're all increasing. I wanted to remind you that elastic constant of solids usually have to satisfy certain relations, because solid must be stable. So for instance, if you try to distort in a particular direction, the distorting forces will always bring it back. So for that's why shear modulus is supposed to be positive. This solid is anisotropic, so those relations are a little bit more complicated. Nevertheless, there are certain combinations of elastic constants which are supposed to be positive. What we found after we derived these numbers, that certain combinations which are supposed to be positive, they were slightly negative, not far away from our error limits, but they were a little bit on the wrong side of stability curve, which should tell us that this configuration is unstable. Unfortunately, we run the simulation and the configuration doesn't go anywhere. And the reason why it doesn't go anywhere, because there are boundaries which kind of keep it in one place. We do not really allow it enough freedom to go somewhere else. So where would such configuration want to go? I want to remind you that there are actually lots of closed pack configurations of ellipses. Now consider having a dense packing of disks. And now take one direction, say this direction, and stretch those disks in that direction and compress them by the same amount in the opposite direction. You will get this configuration, which has exactly the same volume density as the previous configuration. However, you could also do it in a different way. You could stretch it vertically and compress it horizontally. You would get something like that. Notice that this and that are also not the same configuration. So if you rotate that one by 90 degrees, this is not this configuration. Those are two different configurations, having exactly the same density. In fact, there is infinity of such configurations. You can take a two-dimensional packing of disks, choose in some arbitrary direction phi from its axis, some axis A, stretch things along that axis A, compress them in the perpendicular direction, and you will wind up which looks something like that. The axis of the lattice will also rotate a little bit as a result of this distortion, but you will have something which looks like that. All those configurations have exactly the same density. So there is really infinity of closest packings of ellipses with exactly the same density. So how can we know which one of them is the stable state? Unfortunately, as you could see, our Monte Carlo simulation was unable to resolve it because it just didn't go anywhere. So we tried to do something simpler, less accurate, but that still it can be done. we did the following. We performed kind of mean field simulation. Mean field simulation is the following thing. You choose an angle in which you do the distortion, and you distort all the disks into ellipses. After you perform the distortion, you decrease the size of the ellipses just a little bit, while keeping the same aspect ratio. Then you keep all the ellipses frozen in place and allow one ellipse to move, and you calculate what is the phase space available for that ellipse. This is, of course, a very simple-minded kind of mean field calculation, but at least something which we can actually calculate numbers for. And you calculate this available phase space as a function of this distortion angle, and that's what we get. This is the angle phi, and this is the available phase space per atom. It has maximum here, which corresponds to 30 degrees, which is exactly when it points in between two adjacent atoms, exactly as we saw in the picture before. It looked like a natural thing. Think it's elongated. It should point between two other guys. It looks like the best possible positions. This is at some concentration rho equal 1, when I remind you that the maximum is rho is 1.15. This is the maximal possible density. Then we increase a little bit the density, and here is the increased density. The numbers, the absolute numbers on this scale change. They become smaller. We still have a maximum in the same position, but you look, this maximum became very, very flat. And if we go beyond that concentration, we get something like that. The maximum becomes minimum, and actually there are alternative maxima. It means that there are actually other directions which are preferable. So the direction which looked like obvious, self-evident, that should be the optimal configuration, apparently it is not. Apparently there are other directions here. Of course, what has been done here is a very simple-minded mean field. What we're trying to do now, and it's quite difficult, is to do the same. You can systematically improve it. Instead of moving one atom, you can move two and three atoms, etc. But it is very difficult because you actually need to calculate the volume of the phase space. So this is difficult, but it seems that indeed we have here a different possible ground state. Okay, that's more or less everything I had to tell you. So just to summarize, what did I tell you? First of all, I told you that I didn't show you the formulas, but we do have a way to calculate by measuring contact probabilities between the functions. We have a way to measure elastic constants of various quantities, and we can use it to calculate critical indices of percolating systems when this was the case of entropic elasticity. I want to stress at this point that what I showed you, this is only a numerical statement saying that close to the percolation threshold, it behaves like conductivity. We have no proof that this is really a conductivity. Moreover, actually, we know at one of the first transparencies I showed you that system can be solid. It can have shear modulus even when there is no continuous cluster. All you need is to have interlocked objects. In fact, regular percolating system, if you include also the possibilities that clusters from time to time, instead of touching, they just interlock. This threshold is a little bit lower than the percolation threshold. It is lower by such a small amount that it is absolutely indetectable in experiments. But as a matter of principle, the threshold is lower than the percolation threshold. Therefore, whatever I've shown you numerically, I cannot even claim that the threshold itself is exactly the percolation threshold, because obviously if I would be able to do it for huge systems, so in principle I would be able to see some shear modulus even just a little bit below the percolation threshold. So this thing is only approximate, but you know it was done more or less over a range over which the experiments are done. So in that sense, you know, compares well with experimental data, although it doesn't answer the principal question. Finally, The last comment is that we use the elastic constant in our calculation of phase diagram of ellipses. Now, we did it only as an exercise to see if we can calculate elastic constants, but I would like to remark that if we hadn't we calculated the elastic constants, we wouldn't even notice that the phase in which we are working is an unstable phase, because the simulation itself had no indication of instability. Only the elastic constant had some minor indication that those things can be unstable, and this kind of helped us to build the phase diagram a little bit more accurately. Okay, that's all I have to say. Thank you.
If you have a solid, can it has defects? No? Yes. Solids can slide.
Yes.
If you lower them.
Yes.
Now, when have you tried to check if these things can exhibit this type of behavior in the solid phase? I mean, is there a further, for example, sliding transition?
Oh no, but look, these those solids, you know, they have exactly the same, you know, like in a regular solid, you know, it can slide, but that doesn't make it liquid.
No,
because now it's in the in thermodynamic limit, it will not slide. Now simulations. Simulations which we did in two dimensions, they had no defects at all.
Depends that on the concentration, perhaps. It's low enough, there would be room.
The point is that you're working at extremely high concentration. So in order to allow for defects, you need a very big system. We are just unable to do it. I know that people who did three-dimensional, you know, the study of three-dimensional solids has much longer history. And there people actually try to estimate what a defect will do. Because most of the simulations, for instance, that delta F, which I showed you between two free energy difference between HCP and FCC, you know, that calculation was done assuming completely regular structure without no defects. Now you can show that the number of defects decreases when you.
I was wondering, is it conceivable that in the solid phase there is a richer phase structure associated, for example, with the onset, of a sliding transition?
Richer than what? Than the regular solids?
No, you showed the phase diagram at some point.
Yeah.
There was a region, if I understood it correctly, where the thing was behaving as a solid. No.
You're talking about now about two-dimensional or three-dimensional?
You had in two dimensions.
Yeah.
This phase diagram.
Yes.
With an
right. Yeah.
So I was just wondering, I don't know, perhaps it's whether the solid phase may possess a further structure.
Oh, okay. First,
for example, okay. The onset of sliding.
Yeah. Look, the simple answer is I do not know. What we really have here, it's a very approximate. You know, we have kind of separate points here and there. You know, more or less tried to. You know, all those boundaries, they're really qualitative. We were unable to do anything here, because here essentially what we really do, we start with a regular solid without defects. The density is so high that they will not appear, and so you know we simply cannot do it.
What you mean is to put another axis, like a force that is going
to load.
It's not exactly.
No.
I wonder if it would be interesting to look at that.
Yeah, okay, I don't know.
So one of
my,
I want to make sure I understand something you said earlier, and that was this rather robust difference in free energies of the HCC and the FCC, and you made a comment about some range of density for which it probably.
Yeah, of course. The point is.
Is it really? It's 0.001 kd per particle.
Per particle, yeah.
Which is basically an entropy because it's living in some space.
Yeah, that's an entropy difference. Because it's a continuous system, you know, if it would be a real quantum system, so eventually entropy becomes zero and that's it. You know, it would freeze at some point. would be one state and that's it. But this is a classical system. In classical system, you take logarithm of available phase space. The available phase space is just going to zero. So when you take logarithm of something which goes to zero, so it goes to infinity. So essentially, free energy kind of, you can say that it goes to infinity in both systems. But so you have two lines going to infinity, but the difference between them remains the same. What it really says, you can imagine. I'm drawing it in two dimensions, although it should be 1, 2, 3, 5, 6. What it really says that those guys. This center of this atom can live in some, and when you increase the density, this thing just decreases, but the shape remains the same shape. It's the same in three dimensions. But here it's just a hexagon. In three dimensions, those two different shapes for HCP and HCP, but when they go to zero, they remain the same shape, so the ratio between them remains the same.
The reason I'm pushing on it a little bit is we recently derived potentials for noble atomic interactions. And we were just curious how much the different potentials would play a role in the SCC versus HCC. So if I hear such a small number here, and I know that I have a reasonably good potential now, it seems that mostly I should be thinking about energy, I think.
Indeed, it can. In principle, you can easily by fiddling with the potential, you can easily overcome this.
So, in some principle, if I gave you our potential, you could feed that and you could see just how much price you pay. HCC versus FCC.
Yes. But you should keep in mind that this dark calculation is very specific to hard spheres. You really eventually here this. Disk in the middle is just confined to hexagon and that's it. So it becomes kind of trivial. Once you have potential, this entire thing.
But it kind of liberates you to concentrate on potential in a sense. Which is kind of nice.
All it says that really, that the difference is indeed very small.
In the beginning, you showed us. Gave us some background on random assistant network, and then you raised the question. I mean, now if we look at these different kind of things, we have to eventually generalize the theory. Now, for random assistant networks, there are very sophisticated theories, going back to Michael Steven and Harris Lubensky, and more recently, Steno and Janssen developed very detailed theories for random assistant network. Is it possible to learn anything from that and apply it here? I mean, I'm not sure after all the rest you've showed us, there's much more structure and many more questions to be asked. But nevertheless, a natural question would be, can one, let's say, also use some analytical approaches or establish some connection with what is known for random system networks?
No, in random system networks, at least there was one advantage. You had lattice system. You wrote down some dissipation function, and you could say, okay, let's think about it as a Hamiltonian or something like that, and let's see if in some particular n goes to zero limit, happens to that. Now, first of all, with energetic elasticity, nobody wrote down such things. So there is no equivalent to that in discrete case. So now, some things for energetic elasticity, certain bounds, etc., can be derived quite accurately. For instance, those exponents 3.6 or 3.8, you can very easily to derive bounds on those exponents. So you don't really need to solve numerically to see. So certain things are known, but no general formalism for that exists. Now, for the case of entropic elasticity, it's even worse. because you know, in principle, if you look at you know, the basic system where everybody interacts with everybody, you know, you don't even have this thing that, you know, can put on lattice. You know, every atom can interact with any other lattice. So, you know, it becomes very difficult. There are various approaches which try to consider that system in, say, six dimensions, where several things happen. You know, for instance, both excluded volume interactions become irrelevant, and it's also kind of upper critical dimension for the percolation problem. So there are approaches which start from there and do something, but even they are kind of approximate. I never saw, you know, a systematic derivation on the level of mean field, which you may argue will be valid at six dimensions. There are theories which do it.
For these systems, is there a glass transition in your system, or you are just always in a?
No. First of all, all those disks or spheres are the same diameter, so there is really no reason for this thing to become a glass. Now they have their problems. You know, in the simulations, you know, when people study in three-dimensional spheres, when somebody studies melting transition, nobody ever starts with liquid and compresses it to become a solid, because it will never solidify. So it will become glass, but it. Glass, in a sense, it's a numerical glass. So if somebody who wants to study melting transition first artificially creates a solid, and then it decreases and he sees the liquefaction, because the other way around, it's a difficult system to simulate. You know, those hard potentials, you know, once it gets stuck, it gets stuck. It doesn't mean that glass is the, there is no reason for this thing to be a glass. It's true that people who do various jamming transitions, etc. So, you know, there, you know, if you have a little bit friction, but that's really not statistical mechanics. But if you introduce a little bit friction, etc., it immediately becomes, you know, there are all those random closed packings of spheres. You know, once you introduce a little bit friction, you just throw in spheres and they will get stuck there at whatever density you want. So in that sense, you know, it easily creates it. But in thermodynamics, no, you know, there is no reason for. There is nothing particular. You know, it's not difficult to get to the ordered state.
Okay.